Brave New World.
Hello and welcome to Brave New World programme. My name's John Harrison. President Erdogan's narrow victory in the presidential referendum in Turkey last Sunday means that he will soon have American or French presidential powers and a great deal more. He will soon have, for example, the constitutional right to do what, up till now, he has only done by diktat, to purge any judges who deliver verdicts he disagrees with, for example. The tight results, a 1 million vote lead over 49 million, also show that Turkish society is split down the middle as regards this new presidential power, or that the opposition was not allowed to campaign very effectively. To discuss the real situation in Turkey, I welcome to the programme Simon Watmo, a postdoctoral research associate at the European University Institute in Italy. Welcome to the programme, Simon.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
Now, Simon, I mean, what exactly do these results mean? What powers will Erdogan get?
I think it's very clear that the 18 amendments to the Turkish constitution will definitely centralize all executive power in the hands of the president. And the key aspect of it is that he will be able to issue decrees with the force of law, and also most appointments, including to the judiciary and other purportedly independent state institutions. So it really is a tremendous shift in power.
Yeah, it's massive, isn't it? But, I mean, Turkey's hasn't exactly got an exemplary democratic history, has it? You know, looking way back to the history of the Ottoman Empire and so on. Very complex society with a long history of its own. What are the sort of the historical precedents for something like this?
You're definitely right to point out to history. I think Turkey does have a long-standing sort of strong tradition of powerful, charismatic leaders, and the founder of the nation of modern Turkey, Kemal Mustafa Atatürk, is obviously one who's probably very familiar to your listeners. And I certainly think it is true that Atatürk had as much, probably more power than Erdogan even. But I think since 1946, Turkey has had a really, really powerful tradition of parliamentary politics, elections, governments more or less coming and going at the ballot box, a really strong party system and party identification. And I think this sort of undermining of the Turkish parliament that is going to come from these amendments really is quite unprecedented, certainly in the last 80 years of Turkish history, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, looking at it from a distance, I see, you know, the no's out in Istanbul. People voted against his new powers, and that's a city where Recep Erdogan built his power base. And the other two larger cities, Ankara and Izmir, also voted against this. And I gather that the sort of so-called liberal cities, or those often nearer or along the Mediterranean, voted no, and yet he still won, meaning there's a significant groundswell of opinion supporting a strong central power base in Turkish politics. But how did he win? You know, if all these major cities voted no, where is his power base?
His power base is definitely in the rural heartland of Anatolia.
Right.
I think it's true that that demographic really sees Erdogan as a champion for their lifestyles, their interests, and over the last 15 years as well, their economic interests. Because obviously, there's been a tremendous boom in Turkey in the last 15 years, and people have seen real gains. And Erdogan is of those kinds of people. He's really of that, what in Turkey are known as Black Turks, as traditional, conservative, pious, rural Anatolian Turks. And so he's really seen as a champion of that group.
Yeah, I mean, are there any parallels to be drawn here with Trump and Le Pen, perhaps?
I certainly think he's the Turkish version of right-wing populism at the moment. There's no doubt about it. And he's had tremendous success at the ballot box for 15 years off the back of that, for sure.
But the, you know, the results, I mean, do they really reflect the will of the people? He won by, you know, by slither, didn't he, really? You know, 1 million, it's 49 million, for heaven's sakes, you know.
Right.
Some people are doubting the results and the legality of the results. But, you know, what's the connection between his victory and the coup in last year in July? Some people are saying that he used the coup as a sort of way to consolidate his power base. What's your take on that?
I think the consensus is that it's true that without the state of emergency that came after the coup, that there is no way that Erdogan could have won this campaign. And I think there are two things to point out here. The first is the state of exception. The state of emergency has allowed Erdogan to control state institutions, including the electoral board. And I think what's clear is the electoral board would not have certified these results under any other conditions because they were so close and there's been so many irregularities. But the other point, the second point, I think, is just that how uneven the campaign was because Erdogan had so much control.
Yeah.
The media is cowed. There have been hundreds of thousands of people dismissed. The country really is cowering in the face of this man. And I think that that also has played into how the government was able to sort of dominate the media campaign.
Yeah, it's quite frightening. I mean, we've still got dozens of MPs in prison, haven't we?
Right. The leaders of the Kurdish HDP, pro-Kurdish HDP party are in prison. Turkey's the world's number one jailer of journalists. It's a really gloomy situation.
Okay, well, I better not go there for a holiday then. And I gather the no campaign was denied airtime as well?
Correct. I mean, not denied completely, but there was just a radically uneven playing field. I think Erdogan and the government had 7 or 8 times as much airtime as the opposition parties, even perhaps a factor of 10, maybe.
I mean, I just read an article in New Statesman, British magazine, by John Simpson, and he was saying that he felt it was a bit like a sort of underground, the opposition campaign was a bit like a sort of underground movement or something in comparison to the power and the force of the official campaign.
Right, yeah, there was really wall-to-wall, yes, coverage, and the no campaign was at a tremendous disadvantage, which is a real shame. And I think that really goes to show, considering the closeness of the results overall, just how likely it is that had there been an even playing field, the no campaign would have triumphed.
Okay, let's continue our conversation after a short break.
Brave New World.
Welcome back to Brave New World. Today I'm discussing the rather amazing results of the Turkish presidential referendum with Simon Watmo, a postdoctoral research associate at the European University Institute in Italy. Now, I suppose we can talk about Turkey in sort of fairly, I suppose, judgmental and I suppose, critical ways, to be honest, because it is a country that seems to, well, it's a secular country to begin with, and it's also a country which seems to have been able to function fairly well as a democracy. So, you know, this is a situation which theoretically could go either way, couldn't it? And both would be justified. But in terms of, just let's take secularism, what does this mean for Turkey? There's a lot of Turks I know who, you know, live in Moscow, for example, expatriates here. And they talk to them, they're kind of concerned that actually, you know, they're going to be able to have to go back home to a much stricter sort of Muslim environment than the one that they consider to be home right now. But maybe their fears are just based on paranoia and unjustified expectations and so on.
I think that's a really good point, John. I think that there certainly has been a more traditionalist or conservative zeitgeist in Turkey, say over the last 15 years. And it's definitely the case that in the public domain, people who are traditionally pious Muslims have had a lot more opportunity to express their piety. The public sphere in Turkey up until the AKP victory in 2002 was really unfriendly towards the pious majority in Turkey. And let's remember that Turkey is a Muslim majority country. I think this is more really a rebalancing. I think the last 15 years have shown that Erdogan is not necessarily going to stamp out secularism, and that is a tradition that will hold, I think, in the country for sure.
I mean, I suppose on the positive side, one could justify the president's actions and his success in the fact that he will now have the clout, necessary power, to solve his internal problems with the Kurds. And he needs that. He needs, I suppose you could say, the military, you know, needs, demand from him, a fairly sort of authoritarian line here.
Well, I push back on that a little bit, John. I think Turkey's greatest success in dealing with the Kurdish issue and in producing really strong economic growth and economic development over the last 15 years, actually, has been when the country has been moving towards greater democracy, away from authoritarianism. And so I think the answer really is to resolve Turkey's big problems fundamentally, I think, requires more democracy and more political participation. And that includes from within the Kurdish groups as well, I think.
Okay. Now, do you know anything about the military side of things, NATO? I mean, What does this mean for NATO? It's not very sort of convenient for us, is it, to have a sort of authoritarian country within the NATO fold?
Because both organizations champion democratic values as a central criterion for membership, whereas perhaps that wasn't in the past the case for NATO. But I think it's also true, John, that as your listeners will know, the Syrian situation is in such peril and such crisis that I think NATO is probably going to hold, and that the strategic importance will outweigh everything else in the short term anyway.
I think Donald Trump congratulated Erdogan. He was one of the first foreign leaders to pick up the phone and say, well done, you know, which raised a few eyebrows, as they say, didn't it?
It certainly did. But I think it's true as well, the Obama administration prior to the election of Donald Trump also attempted in difficult circumstances to maintain as strong a relationship as it could with the current regime in Turkey as well.
I mean, certainly in terms of Turkey's foreign policy, we've seen an awful lot of ups and downs and U-turns and zigzags and all sorts of things, acrobatic manoeuvres over the last few years. Does this mean that Turkey's going to sort of somehow calm down and become more stable, at least in its foreign policy?
Well, it really depends, I think, on the president and whether he's backed into a corner. This is a president that has used security issues over the last 5 years in particular as pretexts for mobilizing his base and for attacking groups that he perceives as being opposed to him within the country. And what we're increasingly seeing is for external actors like the EU and the Syrians, and even at times the Americans, are used as foils. So I think unpredictability is probably what we can predict, I think, in respect of this president. He's pretty mercurial, and I think it's going to be a rocky ride as we go forward, for sure.
Do you think he'd like to recreate the Ottoman Empire and grab a few more countries on the way, or parts of countries?
No. I'm sure he has a neo-Ottoman vision. I think that's been clear for a while. I think his vision, you know, in the broadest sense for your listeners, is really to recreate himself as kind of the Atatürk of the 21st century, the founder of a new Turkey, a 21st century Turkey that has cultural frameworks that draw on the Ottoman past. And I think he really wants to try to achieve that.
Yeah.
And if he is successful in staying in power for the 100th anniversary of modern Turkey in 2023, that will be a real victory for him.
Within Turkish culture, then, there is a strong support for a strong leader, for centralized control. And that's something that's deep down, is it, within Turkish culture?
And I think one of the challenges of the party system has been traditionally that parties are more focused on their charismatic leaders than on platforms. And this has been a problem in Turkish politics for a while. But I suppose at the same time, there really is a strong tradition of electoral politics and competitive party politics in Turkey. And I think that we don't want to underestimate that tradition. I don't think we want to underestimate the strongman tendencies in Turkey, because I think people do genuinely value their democratic rights and will be prepared to oppose any further diminution of them.
When does President Erdogan actually assume these new powers?
Well, he will face the ballot box again in 2019. And in fact, the amendments won't come into effect for him unless he wins that election. And it is 2019 is a long way away. A lot could happen in the meantime. There are economic clouds on the horizon. And if the economy tanks in the meantime, the prospects for his re-election might dim significantly.
So the relationship between Turkey and the United States and other countries here is crucially important, which gives other countries leverage over Turkey to a certain extent.
I think other countries would be very wise to be cautious about getting involved, simply because the Turks are very sensitive about foreign intervention in their domestic politics. And you don't want to give Erdogan any pretext at all to claim that foreigners are engaging in meddling in local politics.
Wow. Thank you very much indeed for opening the window on Turkey. You certainly are extremely knowledgeable, Simon. Thank you very much indeed.
You're very welcome, John. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Simon Whatmore, postdoctoral research associate at the European University Institute in Italy. And thank you very much, listeners, for being with us today. Tune in again next week. Goodbye.